Welcome to this podcast called Lyttelos, or Listener's Pilot in English. My name is Annabelle Guaita, and I'm a classical pianist.
Then we're here Saturday morning in my flat here in Breistølen in Bergen, and I have today the honor of having Leif Ove Andsnes in my living room at the piano. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Yeah, so, well, we can talk a little bit about how we know each other from way back.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have both studied in Bergen Musikkonservatorium.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go back to 1990. I was a young student, and you were also a young student, but on a quite different level. And
but you started around 1990?
I started in 1990, yes.
I started 86. So
you started 86,
yeah.
I see. Yeah. Yeah, but we are not so different in age. I think you are born 71 as well?
70.
You're born in 70.
70.
So I can remember you playing Grieg Amon minor piano concerts in the small room 206. Which was a normal classroom with Jiri at the other white piano, the other piano playing in the orchestra part.
Mm.
It was a huge experience. So, because you were having less with him for how many years after that?
Yes, I started with, we're talking about our common teacher, Jiri Linka. And I started with Jiri when I was 15, and because I'm from a community further south in Western Norway, in Karmøy, an island. It took 3 hours to drive to Bergen, and I would do that with my parents every 3 weekends and see Jiri for 1 year. I had heard about him through some people, local people there who knew him, and it was very inspiring. And then Jiri said to me, "You should start already when you're 16, when you finished with your 9 years in school, mandatory school. You should start the conservatory already." And this was quite a new thought for me and my parents, and. But I'm really glad he convinced me, because I was really starting to feel more and more passionately about music, and that was would be my life. So when I was 16, I started then quite young at the conservatory, and I could really devote so much time to him. And what was so new for me with him was that there was such a passion about everything, and that music was really life and death, and more important than anything else in life. And I had never met anybody like that. And I felt that also when I came out of a lesson with him, that I wanted to go and practice, because he had shown me that the music could tell stories, that it had so many contrasts and so many possibilities. And I hadn't felt like that before. I hadn't, I was playing naturally the piano and trying to follow my instincts, but suddenly there was more to it and many possibilities. So that was very inspiring and very important to have somebody with such a passion kicking me around for the next few years.
Yeah. Do you remember certain incident or certain piece that he opened especially for you during this time?
There were maybe, I remember a lesson in the Liszt second ballad, which is a very brooding and dramatic piece, and with great lyricism. I mean, it begins with this kind of... very darkness, and then it's the second theme or something. I haven't played it for years, but the contrast in the piece, and there are big marches and big climaxes, and it was so enormous, the feeling of what this music could tell. It's a piece of 15 minutes or so, after I had been working with Iri. So these kind of experiences inspired me so much, and in a way decided for me that I had to be a musician, because I felt it was one of the really important steps for me to understand that I couldn't be without this. And he was so devoted. I mean, because he had himself had to stop to play because of physical problems when he was about 30, and then he ended up in Norway a little bit by coincidence. And when I came around, I mean, he had so much energy to give, and he came with me different places. And when I started traveling a bit and got engagements, and so I became, you know, this energy that he was giving was so important for me. He always said in the beginning, you know, it always takes half an hour before you become warm emotionally. Because I think I was a little bit closed off. I was rather shy as a boy. And I understand today what he meant, because when I first would play something, I wasn't doing the statements clearly. And he felt, you know, I really had to do it more clearly, more dramatic, more lyrical, more, this and that.
Being clear.
That's what's inspiring, being clear about what I wanted.
It's a kind of fascinating that we are still in this very analog tradition, one-to-one teaching, that never can be replaced by books or artificial intelligence or anything that is like very modern at these days, you know?
Yeah.
It's passing knowledge from one person to the other. And we talked a bit about which teachers has been influencing us and how grateful we are about having these influences. It's very, very valuable today. I think, I mean, when we are teaching, we also like passing on this tradition of not just the knowledge about piano and music, but also the knowledge about this one-to-one, what that can actually have as an impact.
Yeah. And it's almost scary what an impact it has, isn't it? Because of course, you know, human beings are good at trying to copy, and you can become a copycat. And but I believe that if you have something in you of a kind of natural musicality or instincts or kind of growing understanding of what music is, and you get these impulses, then you also need somebody who's clear in front of you and says this and that, and then you can sort out for yourself, you know, what you believe in, but of course this is complicated. And then it's the question also, is there right and wrong in music? Or is it simply just a question of taste? A lot of people these days just think it's that music making is not my taste, one says, right?
Yeah. We are very strongly, we want our own individual voice. Like, I like this.
Yes.
I don't like this.
Yeah.
I like this recording. I don't like this recording. Yeah, we were talking about right or wrong. I mentioned to you earlier that I had this feeling when I had been studying that my piano teachers had been teaching me a lot about piano, and I was doing things with music, but I didn't understand why I was doing this, like a little bit softer here, or opening this phrase here, or taking a little more time in this passage, or all these kind of musical things that you apply to the notes, so it becomes alive. But I always had this feeling that there is something more to it. There is an inner logic which I can't grasp. And when I met my teacher, the teacher that made most impact on me, Jordi Mora, then he kind of revealed why does this phrase open? It's not just because there's a harmonic tension. There's a direction here, which is not written in the notes. So I had this feeling that, yes, as you were saying, there's something that is more right than other things.
Yeah.
So we can talk about some kind of truth, or which is, of course, today problematic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think I also had, I think I always actually had this feeling that there is, I was trying to strive for something which was organic, something that where there was an inner logic, as you say. That it wasn't only about taste, and because some performances just felt so much more right to me than others, and right and rich and the truth. You know, I came away from some performances, whether it was for symphony orchestra or for instrumentalists or singers, or, and just feeling this was it. This was, it could not be more or less. And I thought, but was that because of my condition just there? I was open for it, or was there simply something very convincing and right about how it was put together?
When you were performing with another orchestra or another conductor?
Also maybe when I was performing, but I was now more thinking of when I was listening to other performances, yeah. You know, and recordings as well, just thinking that sometimes things just felt absolutely right. And it was difficult to put my finger on what that was. And with the years, I have also been working with musicians who have maybe made that more and more clear for me. It was fantastic what kind of instinct Jiří Hlinka had sometimes when we worked with him. And then when I was about 25, I met also a Belgian piano teacher, Jacques de Thiège, who became also a big influence in my life, who worked in a different way, and also always said to me, you know, you must be a detective in the score, and to find the possibilities what there are, and we have all these different elements. We have melody, harmony, rhythm, and all these things. Of these three things, he said, melody is probably the least important. And I think he's right. I think today it's difficult to say what is more important from rhythm and harmony, but I think both of these are maybe the most important things in, if we talk about tonal music, that is with some tonal centers. And I was thinking about this when I heard your program with your teacher explaining about Grieg's what's called in English homesickness, I think the piece is called, and I always felt in that piece the harmonies are so important, no? And how the harmonies guide the melody.
Exactly.
The harmonies explain the melody.
And I think for a listener's perspective, if somebody is listening to the podcast and is listening to music and not playing,
yeah,
I think there's a big possibility for the listener to listen not only horizontally. Which with the melody always appears horizontally, but this vertical experience. I sometimes say to the audience, try to listen from down and up instead from up and down, because we have a tendency we hear the melody and then we stick to the melody, and it's so easy to grasp a melody, you know? We follow that, but the interesting stuff happens very often in the bottom.
Absolutely.
Of the sound.
I'm reminded of because Jacques de Thiège, I was mentioning, he was basically the first student of Leon Fleischer, who they both died just 2-3 years ago, and Fleischer was a famous piano teacher in and pianist first of all, but then he also, like Jiří, had got physical problems and had to stop playing, basically because of some focal dystonia in his right hand. But Fleischer, and I played for him a couple of times, he was really an amazing musician in some respect. And Jacques was telling me the very first lesson they had together, I think it was a revelation for him, because Jacques had been playing a Schubert sonata, and then Fleischer listened, and then he said afterward, "What is this?" And Jacques thought of it sounds familiar, but I don't know. And he had just been playing it. It was the beginning of the B flat. You know, it was the bass line
it
of
was
that.
The bass line, yeah.
And I was like, oh, he starts with the bass. You know, he starts with that. You know, everybody goes, talks about this melody, how holy this melody is, how difficult it is to shape that this melody, you know, of this grand sonata, and it's 45 minutes of music coming up. It's and we all agonize over that. Mm. But he started a different place. He started with the basic, the boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. Mm. Only that has really a meaning, no?
Mm.
Yeah, both rhythmically, you feel, and an intention and what it creates. So, and he said that just to start listening to aspects like that was the beginning.
Yeah.
And this is very much related, I think, to what you have been working a lot with the I have such a problem saying that word, phenomenology. Right?
I have practiced 20 years to say that word, phenomenology. So I'm a little bit faster now than 20 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah, because in this sense, it's then the bass or the harmony that gives the direction of the melody.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of connection I was looking for when I found this phenomenological approach. Not just that we know which harmony it is, but we know how the harmony actually affects how we should play.
Yes.
So it is a real connection between theory and praxis.
Absolutely.
That phenomenology can give.
I think I had an epiphany when I was about this when I was 10, 11. It was like the first times when I really could sit down and start to play proper pieces. Maybe it was even a little bit earlier. It was, I feel it's around Christmas time and I'm sitting down and I'm opening my father's music of Chopin mazurkas. And some of these mazurkas are not so difficult to play, right? I mean, I could get through bars slowly and so on. And then feeling, these harmonies. You know, one thing is that you have beautiful melodies, but how the melodies are explained by the harmonies you play something. What happens here in the left hand? Mm-hmm. But just to feel the richness of those harmonies, I thought this is what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
How is this put together? I didn't ask myself those questions. It was too early. I was just a child, but I was just so in love with this.
Mm.
And I think that was the beginning. That was what Celibidache talks about also. We just say Celibidache without saying who he is, but famous conductor who was the one really advocating the phenomenology. Right?
Obviously.
Almost.
Yes, absolutely.
And
and
that it's about experiencing.
Yeah.
It's your experience. You cannot prove these kind of rules, but it's all about your experience. And I see that in my life there have been certain moments that have been crucial for my own experience simply of music, of truths in music.
Mm.
And I think it started there. With harmonies.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to talk about the harmony, not something static. It's like, we're not analyzing it on an intellectual level. But it's actually, in phenomenology, we tend to talk about extrovert or introvert harmonies.
Yeah.
And how things are expanding or closing.
Yeah.
And it makes so much more sense than just talking about tonic and dominant.
Yeah.
Because it also gives a word to the sensation. Not necessarily the feeling, but there's like an openness. We say that the harmony is opening. We all know what it means. you know.
It's interesting you use the words of expanding, and because I would usually maybe say tension and relaxation and so on. But I mean, these are words, but they are sometimes important because they can give different feeling.
Yeah.
But let's have an opening to use all of these words. But that there is the harmonies mean certain things. They are opening up new possibilities, or they are giving tension, and then you come back to the home ground. Or
yeah, and tension and relaxation is also very used in phenomenology. But it's also that these words are just pointing at something else. It's not the exact words that it's the word is not the knowledge. It's the experience that we are trying to grasp with words, which only music finally can give us the answer to.
And the experience, of course, is absolutely emotional.
Absolutely, it evokes emotion.
And that's why it's great. Yeah. I mean, that's why we want to be in it.
Yeah.
It's not because we are looking for kind of objective inner logic for the sake of it. It's simply because it feels true, because it's emotionally true.
Yeah.
Right?
And if you look at this Grieg sonata that's standing in front of you, the beginning is a very good example of that, where the melody is... It says the melody says something alone, but the minute you play the harmony to it, the direction of the melody changes.
Yeah, I can play the first four bars maybe. So it wasn't very well played. I didn't play it as I wanted. But we have E minor, right?
Yeah.
And now you feel... more tension, and absolutely more tension.
Yeah.
So
if you play it alone, just play the melody first, without anything. So it's going down. So I experience that it's like this tension.
And this is interesting because I actually recently listened by chance to a pianist playing this on the radio. And the pianist tried very deliberately to make one line and started, and I can see the logic, wanting to start very soft, and then gradually. But there's something wrong in that. And I was thinking, and it is because it is a kind of calling first, isn't it? It starts on the ta-ra-ra. But then, of course, there is more tension. But the first is really going down, don't you think?
Greg writes piano, so it's he says, okay, it's only piano, and then there is this da da di da accent da di.
Yeah.
And this accent, it's on the one.
Yeah.
So it's on the one, and Greg writes also accent to this. So it gives some kind of feeling of culmination. This is where we're going.
Absolutely.
But still it's like this tension. Da di da di di da di da di da. So if you make a lot of crescendo, you're going against this natural tendency of coming down. But then again, the harmony is saying, "Oh, we're going to support this falling down." So
because
have two
the harmony
forces.
Goes two normal bars and then
opening.
I mean, I'm exaggerating now, but just to show that the harmonies.
Yeah.
So and together with the right hand, then this becomes a lot of tension in the third and fourth bar. And also, of course, you could say then, okay, only do it with the left hand to grow with the left hand. But of course, the left hand cannot also be louder than the melody, so we must also support the melody there in the third and fourth bar. So. So it's a very simple phrase, but it's in a way divided into two. I feel like the line starts like a calling, comes down, and then gives more tension in the third and fourth bar because of the harmony.
And then the rhythmical aspect is also interesting because it starts on a one body, which is also tension. Yeah. More or less. Pum, pum, ba-dee-da, more or less. So the rhythmical has also its own tensions and distensions, which goes together with the harmony and melody.
It's true. It's true. And some criticize Grieg, especially in this early period, for not being so great with writing big form sonatas. And I can see why, but I like this compact Grieg very much. I mean, this first movement is just 3 minutes or so. But it becomes very clear because he doesn't have long periods of transitions or so. But it has to be then very clear as a statement what you want with the phrases. Mm. Yeah.
And this is very interesting what we are doing now, because now we are kind of discovering the piece. We are not interpreting it so much as discovering, which is...
I haven't played it for a long time, so I'm just looking like from scratch here, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the next four bars here is maybe more clear direction, because he also writes a crescendo and the melody goes up. And then with the help of the harmonies... So it's a sequence, right? The same thing happens. And it goes up. And then a bar of tension.
Culmination there. Maybe.
Yeah, culmination. Yeah. And this is ornamentation of that in a way.
So is the harmonic tension stronger here?
At the end?
Or in the end, when it's going to fortissimo?
Yeah, when he goes on. It goes on, of course, after this. And we continue in the same harmony. So I think not more. But even more tension now. So here it grows also, and it goes through the dominant. And also it's interesting to see how he, in a very simple way, starts to orchestrate the piano differently here, no? Suddenly he becomes more orchestral with these chords.
Yeah.
So he also wants to help the tension by the way he writes for the piano, because then the theme comes. Which is completely different, and it's like a fanfare, and it's a canon. It's first... And then starts the bass with the same theme. So he makes it even more compact, and these two voices intensifies the music by working together.
I remember a phrase from my teacher that meant a lot to me in a transition like that, when you have finished one part and you're going on with a part which is stronger and more energetic.
Yeah.
He said, you have to create the necessity of going on.
Yes.
I like this word necessity, that you really need to go on. So how do you create this necessity before it comes fortissimo there?
Yeah, I think I love that. I love that word as well, because what we want is that something feels inevitable. It has to happen.
It has to happen.
And for that, we have to create the necessity. I think Grieg helps us with some things here, like for instance that the left hand goes up. You know, it already starts here. And then it's the same harmony, but now, and then the next, with a new harmony, with more tension, this is something that really helps, and we can use this also rhythmically in a way, with real direction in this. Because you see, the right hand doesn't have this kind of direction in a way, it's more kind. It doesn't have these intervals going up. So for me, the left hand here is in a way, the motor that drives this necessity, if you want, onto the B chords. And then,
Yeah, because the melody, it happens a lot on the one.
Yes.
Da, di, da, 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 da. So it's very static in a way. And the left hand is coming to give energy to that little bit static melody.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. There are these asymmetrical elements are important often in creating this kind of movement and this kind of necessity. And this is such a place.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic that the composer like Grieg has this knowledge or instinct that he knows that this is needed, you know, for creating the necessity for the crescendo.
Yeah.
How it can intensify. I mean, if he wrote something like, I mean, that is very flat, right?
Yes.
But we think we have heard that with a lot of less good composers, maybe, right? But he knows that if he then, then you feel there is really something happening here.
There's a tension in this first.
Yeah. Yes, and this, what you said is this. This gasping, this breathing very quickly, that creates a tension.
But let's open up a little bit more. What do you do as a performer? I mean, it's already written. How do you actually make it come alive? Is it possible to talk about this? What do you feel? How do you kind of interact with the notes?
Well, I think. Exactly, looking at this aspect. I mean, I think when I teach, I think the phrase I use the most is "look what happens in the left hand." I think for pianists, it's so easy that our ear goes to the most obvious, which is maybe most often the melody in the right hand, the upper melody, and. We forget the bass and we forget the inner food of the music, if you want. And very often that happens in the left hand.
So what you're saying is just to pay attention.
To pay attention. Yeah, I mean, something as simple as I mean, we have the first chords here. And then this wonderful bass. For the first time, the bass changes from, we have E, and then, that's so important. I mean, the bass is so important. Mm. I think sometimes it's the most important. Also, if you hear a symphony orchestra, where the chords don't start from the bass, there's something unsatisfying, right?
Yeah.
With some great orchestras, you can hear that they are trained to make it, to listen to where the chord comes from the ground up.
Yeah.
And that's more easy because they play their notes in a connection with others, but we have to do everything at the same time as a pianist, so it's more complicated.
Yeah, there's a lot of energy in this sonata. It's a kind of a restlessness I feel is lying in this.
Absolutely. If we go on a little bit with this sequence, so we have the next coming out. So that's simply a sequence, just moving up, but also that is really the tension, right? So here he changes. I find it also fascinating because we have had very symmetric, like you said, it's always one. And now he probably instinctively feels that he cannot go on with this one. Mm. He has to have something asymmetric. So two. And that also drives the music forward. And now symmetry. One. Right?
Exactly, yeah.
So this... Fantastic. This is something I often look for, this kind of joy of symmetry and asymmetry. This is something which is rhythmically driving the music very much, I find, and which makes such a piece very interesting and diverse.
Yeah, and this is food for the pianist to articulate.
Absolutely.
Because Grieg has been sometimes criticized for repeating too much, and it becomes... That it becomes too much sequences, like equal sequences, just like the Cello Sonata,
yeah,
Opus 45.
Right, right.
That is kind of repeating itself too long. But I remember we discussed that very much at school.
Yeah.
What to do with all these long sequences.
Yes.
Should we make a cut because it's too long, it gets boring? Or should we kind of actually go in as musicians and do something to keep it alive? And maybe that's what you're talking about here, that all the takatakatira, takatakatira, another time, takatakatira, takatakatira, another time, takatakatira. He repeats himself, but we can actually do something to
absolutely, and to keep it alive. For me, this repeating, 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 it's a kind of, it can be a kind of obsession, which has such a meaning. Now, I remember with somebody like Beethoven does this so often. And if you play a piece like the Appassionata, boom, 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 boom. You know, this kind of obsession which this piece can become if you listen to what happens in this rhythm. Of course, then there's a melodic line over the little, but boom, boom, you know. And for a whole piece, almost the same thing happens again and again. But I think this can be so exciting. And and then it moves up, and then you feel my God, something has to happen. You know, if you look at these eight bars in such a way, I think it's very exciting. I can try to play it. Maybe not. And then you feel, oh wow, okay, what the climax this becomes then.
I know when you're playing, when you're playing it, I can really feel that you are believing it. You're believing what you're saying.
Yeah.
So it's very important to believe what the composer has written in order to communicate that it works. There's no room for doubt in a way.
It's true.
Kind of, I think someone
who said this that will is in a way underrated. Think of how much will somebody like Beethoven had. You know, how much there's such a courage in having this will. And one needs to believe, one needs to feel that the performer believes in something, no, that there is a consequence and that there is something. So anyway,
so in this sonata form, then this second theme is very important. Now, we have been talking with Jordi about something he calls complementarity, how two themes fit together. They must be different, but not so different that they don't fit together. So can we look a little bit at on how the second theme fits together with the first theme in this sonata?
And what is challenging in this sonata is that sometimes there's so little time between, because it's so compact, that, for instance, we go after this sequence, again, comes another sequence after what I played. Big climax. And now there's one bar to go from this to the second theme. So this bar is, you know, it's an enormous contrast. So you just go from something so desperate to, what is this second theme?
Yeah,
it's so almost a little bit trivial and very gemütlich, very charming. Yeah.
exaggerated a little bit, but there is a sequence, of course, from the fifth bar. So it goes up. We're starting in G major, and then it goes to to parallel tonality, but now in minor. So it has more tension and maybe then giving more. And the theme itself is interesting, no? I mean,
yeah, and the,
what is it?
And the complementarity here is also that the beginning of the theme, in both the first theme and the second theme, is on the first beat. Then the rhythmical tension comes in the third bar in the first theme. And so it does here. He has some kind of rhythmical asymmetry that comes to liven up this,
which is comes from the main theme from the third bar, and here distorted rhythm. And then this third and fourth bar, what is this now? It's a kind of mild calling, but it's also less intense, no? It must be within the atmosphere we have created.
Yeah. So very similar. It's like a tension in this. Going back.
Going back, yeah.
So kind of a very rhythmical, dance-like second theme in contrast to the more dramatic singing.
Absolutely.
A restless first theme. So emotionally, there's also a contrast.
Yeah. And that's, so you're right. It should be related, but also emotionally, of course, all the great composers work with contrasts. So as a second theme like this will be naturally very different from the first theme to create an emotional contrast.
Yeah.
And he does it so well also in the second part of this second theme, because after this jumping, then the next is a very lyrical, dreamy character. Here again, what is it? It's a there's not so many possibilities to do what to do with that melody if one doesn't really look at what happens at the harmony, which is it relaxes a little bit the first time it goes up, right? So he transcends this, it becomes eight bars with instead of just two, twice four.
What do you think? Interesting, because normally it's like you have the second theme and this is built out, so there's complete second theme that feels like a complete section, but Grieg is jumping to another idea here. And what is that? And does it really become fulfilled here? Or is it just an idea that it's not quite worked through? Maybe that's why he takes it in the coda.
And he takes it also in the coda, this element, right? You know, and he really makes something out of this. Yeah, that's true. Maybe he just felt instinctively that this needs to be worked more, and we need to find a conclusion for that in the coda.
Yeah.
But I find what he does.
So for the listener who doesn't know what a coda is, let's explain this.
Yeah, sorry. It's an end of. Well, what does it mean actually as a word?
Coda, I don't know. Yeah. We were taught in the school, it was called like a tail, but it's like a closing,
it's a closing
section of a piece that comes. But what phenomenology taught me, or through Jordi's teaching, was that this coda, the function of the coda is to take what's been built up and release it, so we can finally end the piece. We can finally feel that the piece has come to an end.
Yeah, yeah.
So if there's something left which is not really developed, it has to come back in the coda.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a necessity for a coda to explain something more, right?
Like if you've been fighting with a friend and you haven't seen this friend for many, many years and you still feel there is some tension. You meet him on the street and you say, oh, nice to see you. And then you have this urge to say, I'm sorry for this incident. Or that you take the tension up again, but it's in the light of the time that has passed.
Hmm.
The tension is resolved because you're Sally saying the things, the same things, but in a different way.
Mm. I'm thinking, Mozart often, I find, introduces just a little small new melody at his codas, you know, like a kind of relief that explains the rest of the movement, but which is actually a new element. I always find that so beautiful. But I was just, maybe we don't need to go so much further on into the development here, but just at the end of the second theme, which is so short from Grieg, I think he combines a little bit what I talked about from earlier in the left hand. He combines this here with now or so this comes back here and creates tension together with this line in the right hand. That's full of tension, right? And then it comes down. Yeah. It's very clever. Put together such a thing. And this is what we can do as musicians. Of course, we can analyze it from a point of theory. I almost never do that. And I have to admit also very often, I don't know what things are called from a theoretical point of view. I don't do really a harmony analysis as such, though I can find it interesting to read about sometimes, but to feel how it's expanding, like you say, or how it's tension and relaxation in the harmonies. That's absolutely essential to me in music making.
And it's so interesting to talk to you about these things and listen to you explain how you see the music. It almost feels like you are unwrapping the music for me. You wrap up a gift and it exposes what's inside, because even as a musician, very often I feel that if I listen to a piece of music which is not so familiar with, then the music passes very quickly and I don't get to hear all these amazing details.
Yes, yeah.
So I wonder if this could be kind of the new way of outreach to audience, because I mean, it's a fact that we are not so good listeners today as we were maybe 20 years ago because of internet, and we don't read long texts anymore. We have problems concentrating. And music happens in time. So I wonder if this kind of unwrapping could be a new way of introducing concerts in concerts hall.
Right, yeah.
So not just talking about the composer, but actually showing a little bit how to listen to this piece, what's inside.
Yes.
How can we kind of grasp moments which normally just passes very quickly.
I think you're right. I mean, that feeling is so wonderful when we feel somebody really explains it, and maybe we have to be better at doing that also with words, or a little bit like I feel more and more that the audience needs introduction to things. No, they want to know.
They want to know. Yeah.
People want to know. I mean, if I go into a gallery And the artist or the curator or whoever will tell me, look at how the light falls down here because of the shape of this, and it you know, whatever. Then I have one or two or three things to look. I will look differently at the painting. I will think that I have seen or understood something a little different, or experienced it, maybe.
Yeah.
If it makes sense. And I feel there is a real hunger among audience for getting those a little bit of tools. You don't have to, I mean, you can just listen to music instinctively, and it is such an immediate language, and some people just feel extremely emotional immediately about it. But I think just to have a few tools to listen to things it can really help the audience, these days. And that's why it's so great that you're doing this kind of program. I think there's such a need for it these days.
Yeah, because I talk to audience a lot, and I notice that when the feedback they are giving very often goes in the direction that they are impressed on something. Oh, this pianist was fantastic. I'm so impressed, and it was so amazing.
Yeah.
And it's like very focused on the performer and very little on the music. That was the reason why I wanted to do this listener's pilot, because I wanted to put back the music on the stand in a certain way.
Yes.
So we can be very fascinated by the music itself a little bit, and take a little bit apart this performer, that we are amazed about this fantastic performer.
Maybe it's also because it's people in general find it's very difficult to talk about the music,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because it's kind of abstract for a lot of people, and then it's easier to say that, oh, that the piano, did you look at the pianist's hands? It was so amazing. But maybe that was the feeling for them, but would it have impressed them if the music didn't impress them? I don't believe that. I mean, who is interested in looking at some fast hands? I mean, that's nothing.
If you didn't
have the sound, then
absolutely.
So I agree with you. We should get to what the music is about. And just by the way, I mean, looking at this sonata, you say things are going so. It's a good example because things are really going fast by, and it reminds me, I think it was the pianist Geza Anda that said once, you know, people talk about when you get older you play slower, and very often, and people say it's because you cannot anymore play as fast, and that's absolutely wrong, but it's because you get more and more experience and you want to hear different things in the music.
Yeah,
and I think that's interesting. And that I feel with the years, that there is more and more inside the music that I want to explain or unwrap, like you said, and I want to hear for myself the inner food, not just the obvious thing, the melody and the obvious contrast, but what's inside the music. And that's why sometimes one needs more time then. Celibidache, and his as a conductor, his development as a conductor, how slow his music making was at the end.
Yes,
it was extreme sometimes. No, and but I'm sure most of the time in the hall, if you were in the hall and listened to what he was listening to, it made perfect sense in itself.
Yeah,
because his development was that he needed to that time for listening to all the important aspects.
Yeah, he said the more expressive the music is, the more time it needs to evolve in our ears.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Glenn Gould, I was thinking about his Goldberg Variations.
Yes.
The later recording. Of course, he wasn't the old man when he was recording it, but that is very, very slow.
Much, much slower than the early one. And doesn't need to be better, but his need to have it slower because of wanting probably to listen to other aspects of the music. Yeah,
yeah. And I think there's also a tendency in people in general that I noticed that we are, as human beings, now hungry for deep experiences. I mean, people, they're going to to ice bathing, or they would jump from cliffs, and want to have strong experiences that kind of move them. And we need strong experience to feel alive. And I think that there's so much potential in music, but we are a little bit lost because we need help to understand what's in it. And you listen to a piece of music, it's so easy that the mind drifts off to some kind of dream or fantasy or idea that the music evokes. And then you kind of start to listening to your own thoughts more than to the music. And I asked a lot of audiences about this. What were you thinking when I was playing? And then they start to telling me about this memory that the music evoked instead of being close to the music. So I think this way of unwrapping the music can be a very big potential in concerts today. That we're not necessarily only speak about the composer and how the piece was made and in which year, and which is also interesting sometimes, but doing this kind of just show a little bit what's fascinates you with this music.
Yeah.
Then now I really want to hear the whole sonata being played through.
And interesting. I was just doing a tour with where I played this new, there's a big sonata by Geir Tveit, number 29, which is over half an hour piece. And I thought that I need to say something to the audience before that, because outside Norway, he's not a known composer at all. And they're going to hear a really big piece. And if it's an obscure composer for them, how, you know, they need some kind of framework. So I said a little bit about the composer's life, but also about the music. And and at the core of that piece, there are two small themes that run through the whole piece, actually. They're very folk tune-like. And then the second theme is... And somebody said to me after I'd introduced in Berlin, a friend said to me, you know what you should do instead of just saying that there are two folk tune melodies, you should also play them.
Hmm.
And of course he's right, you know. But we sort of hesitate to do that a little bit. We don't want it to be a seminar.
Exactly.
And but actually people need it.
Hmm.
People want that.
Then they hear it.
Then they hear the two themes and they will hear it through the piece. And they will relate to it, you know, when things happen around it, and he varies this in thousand ways. And that's actually what carries the piece. But the themes are there and they can hear it.
And the bonus is that you get to know the performer a little bit more than just you coming in and play and then you go out again. You get to know a personality.
Yeah.
And what's important for you. And I think that creates a bigger connection with the audience.
Yeah, that's funny. I always... I'm surprised about that, actually, what an effect it makes that you say something.
Mm.
I still cannot put my finger on why is it like that. But it's maybe also just showing in a different way than playing how passionate I am about it.
Hmm.
Just also with words.
Yeah.
And words are more concrete than music, and maybe, but just then, and they are totally limited. I mean, you cannot express the music with words. That's why we have music. But maybe it's a way to get to people also to show that side.
Mm.
Because we have to realize also for a lot of the audience, it's totally enigmatic what we do and what we are. We just sit down and we are inspired artists finding this music and pouring out our feelings, you know. No, it's a little bit more thinking and experiencing and than that. And
And you break down the barriers between scene and the stage and the audience.
Yeah,
which
probably
we really need to do it now.
I always do that in Norway when I play in smaller places because they are not so used to this kind of concert. But I felt now also playing
international concert and with this Tveit, it was absolutely necessary to do such a thing.
Yeah, and you soon have your festival in Rosendal.
Yes.
Do you want to tell me a little bit of what you do to... I mean, I see in the program, it seems to me that you always focus on finding really, really great pieces and a strong theme for the festival musically.
Yeah.
Well, what, do other things that can help people coming more inside the pieces?
Yeah, I mean, it's a chamber music festival in Rosendal, and what's the advantages with, and what is really fun with the program is that I try for not one or two artists to have one program, but for the artists that come there, they take part in maybe five or six programs in different pieces. So you play one piece in one program, and then you listen to your colleagues doing other things. So in one piece, you can have a piece for piano. In one program, you can have a piece for piano. Then you have a string quartet. Then you have some songs, and you have an ensemble piece. So you can, which is the difficult programs to put together in other circumstances than if you have a festival like that. And then for me, it's important to speak with the audience a little bit about the programs. I often speak before a concert, just a little bit, how I've been thinking to put together the program, or I get some of the artists to say something, or we have somebody giving some lectures about what is going on. So this summer I will have a Hungarian theme, for instance, with Hungarian music, and then I have the feeling that people want this. They want to go into something and try to go a little bit deep into one theme and to understand. And when you then, like last year, we did massive amount of Brahms, like 15 of his big chamber music pieces, and they are not exactly short journeys. And it was kind of exhausting because his music is so filled with meaning and intensity somehow, and so structured and everything. But then we felt really enriched by it, and you see the composer in a different light when you hear so much.
So it's like a deep dive, deep dive into one composer, which is also meaningful because it takes time to get to know to get into this language. Brahms, for example, has.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it becomes a...
Yeah, so by the third or fourth concert, it's a little bit more, maybe by itself, becomes easier to grasp a little bit about what the music is about.
Yeah, shall we wrap it up? Mm-hmm. Not wrap it up in this sense, but wrap the conversation up. That's been really, really nice talking to you. And
thanks, likewise. I love this way of thinking about music, what you do, and to explain, to try to get people into the music. I mean, I think the common word of what we really want to do is to share this great thing that we feel we have experienced in the music, and we have to do that in as many ways as possible.
And you speak as a musician, and very often when you go to concerts, people who speak before concerts, they are either musicologists or they have their roots in history, or they are teachers. But I think the language we can use as musicians is different, simply different. And I really hope we have
experience from the music making.
Exactly.
So at least we can bring some of that, try to bring some of that into to explain verbally as well what it has done with us, this experience. Yeah.
Yes. So let's keep on working on that.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Zehua. Thank you so much.
Thank you.